Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to Sparks. This week, a letter from the DTI and our reply. Industrial spying. Digital audio in TV. Ceramic switches. Something quite intriguing about carburettors. And of course your letters, so stay tuned. It's Sparks from Radiofax 6205 and 12255. Braving the summer wasps, to bring you a letter from Martin Price from Shrewsbury. Picked up your Sparks format, he writes. All very interesting. Wishes us good luck. As you may know, South Shropshire is famous for the Radio Sunshine pirate radio station, operated close to Ludlow in South Shropshire for 12 months or so. It's now on 1117 kHz incidentally, and it has a test and development licence and can be heard for quite a few miles around. Not bad for something that's reportedly less than a watt. So, thanks Martin Price, writing from Shrewsbury. If you would like to write to us, it's Sparks, every Monday and Tuesday, Radiofax's technical programme of news and features, 6205 12255. The address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. We'll give you a reply if you send us 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1, and we'll definitely give you a mention on this programme.
Ceramic spin-off challenges metal contacts. This is a story passed on to us by Les Ward of Hucknall in Nottingham from Electrical Review. And it's about ceramic substitutes for electrical contacts. While searching for a solid-state alternative to the thermostat, a Tyneside sensor maker has stumbled across a family of materials which it believes could pose a challenge to traditional electrical contacts, provide the basis for solid-state rechargeable batteries with significant advantages over existing secondary batteries, and change colour when stimulated electrically. Elmwood Sensors' discoveries stem back to the early 1980s, when the company was dependent on an aging technology, the electromechanical thermostat, for its existence. It realized that the thermostat would eventually be superseded by solid-state technology, although it was not clear what form this technology might take. So, Elmwood set up a research team to find a solid-state method of switching currents at a preset temperature. As Peter Thompson, the company's technical director, puts it, "We began to search for the Holy Grail." One promising prospect was a group of materials known as electroactive ceramics. These were already used in the positive temperature coefficient thermistor, a device whose resistance increases dramatically as it is heated above a critical temperature. In 1982, Elmwood bought a division of NEI Electronics, specializing in this technology. Based on this acquisition, Elmwood formed a materials group operating at arm's length from the rest of the company. It reached an unusual arrangement with the University of Durham, under which a team of Elmwood researchers worked in the university's Department of Applied Physics. Positive temperature coefficient thermistors are now an established Elmwood technology, but they have limitations. For instance, when cold, they still exhibit a small resistance, enough to produce heating in some applications. And when heated above their switching temperature, they do not completely isolate a circuit as a true switch would do. So, Elmwood is still looking for a solid-state temperature switch. However, in the course of its investigations, the research team has discovered groups of ceramic materials with applications reaching far beyond the world of temperature sensing. One group, consisting of oxides in pairs of metals, such as zinc and tin, is showing promise as an alternative to conventional metallic contacts in switches and circuit breakers. Although metals have obvious attractions for use as contact materials, they are relatively cheap, easy to shape and join, and are available in a variety of proven alloys, they also have drawbacks. For instance, they can be contaminated by a reaction with air, water, or chemicals. Their performance can also be degraded if they become coated with particles. One technique for minimizing this risk is to restrict the contact area to a knife edge, but this in turn can lead to high current densities and to overheating, possibly deforming or welding the contact. Elmwood researcher Dr. Jenny Illingworth says that ceramic contact materials could avoid these problems. The materials she has been studying are formed from metal oxide compounds, which, when fired in a similar way to pottery at a temperature above 1000 degrees centigrade, form pale yellow material. Initially, these materials act as insulators, with conductivities of 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 8 ohms per centimeter. But when heat treated in a reducing atmosphere at a few hundred degrees, they undergo dramatic changes in color to dark gray and in electrical characteristics. They now have conductivities similar to those of steel. Moreover, unlike metals, their conductivity increases with temperature. According to Illingworth, These ceramics have several important advantages over metal contacts. They are chemically inert and immune to the effects of arcing, which can pit metallic contacts. They have already done all their reacting at 1100 degrees centigrade. They are not prone to the softening or melting, which can damage metal contacts. Their rough surfaces can accommodate particles without affecting performance, and they can operate at temperatures up to 1100 degrees without needing precious metal protection. They also offer a wider range of design options than metals, providing either large or small contact areas. One of the earlier drawbacks of ceramic materials, the difficulty in making connections to them, has been solved by recent developments in brazing techniques. Elmwood is now looking for licensees for the contact technology, initially within the Hawker Siddeley Group, of which it is a member. Thompson envisages the materials being used in switches handling currents up to around 30 amps. He says the costs should compare favourably with those of precious metal contacts. One of the characteristics exhibited by the ceramic materials, their colour change, has been investigated by the Elmwood researchers for other applications. In particular, they have been looking at the behaviour of a group of ceramics known as ternary oxides, whose members include cadmium germanate and zinc stannate. Dramatic changes in colour can be produced in these ceramics not only by annealing the material in a reducing atmosphere, but also by applying a voltage as low as 2 to 3 volts across it. The change in colour is almost instantaneous. No structural changes occur in the ceramics as they change colour. The process can be reversed by changing the polarity of the voltage, and repeated indefinitely. Elmwood's senior scientist, Dr. Toraj Hashemi, sees the electrochromic ceramics being used as thin film coatings for car rear view mirrors, which would darken automatically if a car with bright headlights approached. A similar application could be as a coating for windows, which could go dark automatically, avoiding the need for blinds. The electrochromics could also be used to produce calculator displays, which would not be subject to the critical viewing angle, which limit the effectiveness of liquid crystal displays. Elmwood is seeking licensees for the electrochromic technology. Meanwhile, its quest for a solid-state alternative to thermostats continues. That item from Electrical Review.
Thanks, Les, for sending that in. He writes about sparks. It's good to hear a decent programme after all that mindless music.
Oh, the leaden window opened. A trundle, the dancing candle flame. And the first moss of summer, suicidal came. Oh, suicidal came, and the new breeze chattered in its Maybach tenderness, sending water lilies sailing as she turned to get undressed, and the long night awakened. And we soared up out of wings, circling our tomorrows in the weary month of spring, chasing shadows slipping in the magic lantern slide, the reaches of the candle. Oh, the night is light, rising, dipping and weaving, reflected through the golden needle's eye. In our haystack madness, butterflies floating on the springtide high, on the springtide high. said, as the candle burned and the moth were wet, and we'll all burn together as the wick grows higher, we'll be here for the candle's end. The window opened to move the dancer candle flaming, and the first month of summer, suicidal game, oh, suicidal game, to join in the worship of the light that never dies. Reflection up to my fitting in the right.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radio Fact Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck, and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
A fully digital signal chain will be found first in broadcast and post-production studios, reports Francis Rumsey in Pro Sound News. Marginally improved sound quality alone is not the guiding factor on determining whether a completely digital signal chain is something to strive for. Many have said that the sound from an analog mixer is to be considered preferable until such time as a collection of second-generation digital multi-track music consoles take over from Neve's pioneering products of the 1980s. A selection of major mixer companies do have large-scale second-generation digital consoles planned. Indeed, AMS has just launched its Logic 2, although the economic climate at the present time is not sufficiently buoyant to encourage such projects. The Broadcast Studio Centre and the post-production facility are currently the most likely places in which to encounter fully digital signal chains in the near future, and the reasons for this are not difficult to see. Digital workstations are being adopted very rapidly as an ideal means of dubbing sound to picture and maintaining a library of effects. Video recording is in the process of going digital with the adoption of D1, D2 and DX machines by television companies, and digital video recorders, DVTRs, offer 4 digital audio channels. Also, stereo television sound is now broadcasting in many areas using NiCam 728, a digital transmission system, and sound is distributed around the broadcast network by using a digital sound in sync system. The television sound dubbing environment is also usually less channel hungry than multi-track music recording, making it a more realistic proposition to adopt a digital mixer for handling the signals from the workstation. And, finally, television post-production often involves many generations of copying, a fact which needs not affect quality of picture or sound if it remains in the digital domain throughout. It is important to note that many digital workstations have mixing facilities of various sophistication on board, and that for many television sound dubbing operations these may be all that is required, obviating the need for an external mixer, except perhaps for peripheral tracks, such as the playing in of analog sources. Screen sound from Solid State Logic, DAR's sound station, and the Waveframe audio frame offer panning and level control on all output channels, as well as equalization in some cases, whilst AMS offers an external digital mixer to complement the audio file. Changes in gain and stereo position may be programmed into the edit list so that these parameters change at the appropriate timecode location automatically. Using such a system, it would be relatively easy to keep sound in the digital domain from start to finish of a television production, with original sound from DVTRs laid off onto the workstation, CD-derived music and effects, and digital wild tracks gathered using DAT, and again laid off onto the workstation. In this case, the all-digital route is the obvious choice, and sound quality may be maintained throughout the many generations which often ensue in television post-production. Television South West in England has purchased an AMS Logic One mixer to work with the audio file, as much because of its automation as for the sound quality benefits of digital audio, and this is clearly a pointer to the future. Similarly, Sony's new digital audio mixer, the MXP2900 series, has been designed with video post-production in mind, since it can be interfaced to edit controllers and used for automating the control of audio from a number of DVTR sources, very much as a vision mixer handles vision cuts, fades and effects. The Sony mixer even looks, for all the world, like a vision mixer. Thames Television has done pioneering work in the field of the all-digital signal chain and should soon be ready to claim DDDD in many cases on its broadcasts. As Thames's head of technical projects, Paul Evans, recently pointed out, the adoption of a digital audio transmission standard now means that it is possible to encode the audio signal at source, to edit, process, and finally transmit to the consumer entirely in the digital domain. All of this is now possible without any intermediate decoding of the signal into an analog format. Thames's Euston site, studio centre and presentation suite has been equipped for stereo by adopting M2 video machines with digital audio soundtracks, and a purpose-built digital presentation mixer handles digital signals from the NICAM Sound in Syncs network, which carries sound to and from other studio centres and to the transmitters. The transmitters themselves then broadcast sound on NICAM digital stereo without intermediate conversion back into the analog domain. AES EBU interfaces carry stereo digital audio signals around the studio center, and these signals can be carried over cabling previously installed for mono analog audio in many cases, provided that suitable digital distribution amplifiers and correct termination are employed. It is suggested that we may expect the fully digital signal chain to emerge rather more slowly in music recording than in broadcasting, and that the reasons for its quicker adoption in television post-production may have more to do with practicality than sound quality alone. With digital audio can come increased operational flexibility in terms of the number of generations of copying allowed, the speed of post-production, and the ease of signal distribution on large networks, for example. But at the moment, such operational advantages are not high on the priority list of the typical music studio, and are likely to remain in that state until the recording business is eventually revived. That piece by Francis Rumsey in ProSound News Europe.
knows, or is it just my daylight song? What I do ain't make-believe. People say I sit and try, but when it comes to being daylight, it's just me, myself, and I. Plug one style and my plug one spectacles. You say plug one and two are hippies. No, we're not. That's pure plug bull. Always pushing that we formed an image. There's no need to lie. When it comes to being plug one, it's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. Me, myself, and I. Proud, I'm proud of what I am. Poems I speak are plugged too tight. Please, oh please, let plug to be himself, not what you read or write. Right is wrong when hype is written on the soul, they lie, that is. Style is surely our own thing, not the false disguise of showbiz. They lie, soul is from the soul, and this fact I can't deny. Strictly from the Dan called Stucky, and from me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. One and two, but that glory's been denied by cassettes and gookie eyes. People think they diss my person by stating I'm darkly packed. I know this, so I point at Q-Tip and he states
black is black.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, shovel chestnuts in my path. Just keep all nuts with the nuts so I don't get an aftermath. But if I do, I'll calmly punch them in the fourth day of July, cause they try to mess with third degree. That's me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I.
Building syndrome. Many office workers are finding that their workplace is a serious hazard to their health. From Here's Health. The British Lung Foundation has recently sponsored a major inquiry into why, contrary to expectation, the office can be one of the less healthy working environments. Researchers have examined a wide range of buildings, and office workers have been asked to keep a daily record of their state of health. Analysis of the results sheds new light on the office worker's biggest hazard, the sick building syndrome. The most common complaint is of lethargy or tiredness. Some people get worse shortly after arriving in the building and improve shortly after leaving. But there are others who become profoundly lethargic during the day and stay extremely tired in the evening after leaving work. The lethargy is sometimes associated with a dull tension headache, with the pain usually above both eyes and sometimes at the back of the neck. The other frequent symptom is a blocked or runny nose, similar to that of hay fever. Less common complaints are sore or itchy eyes, problems wearing contact lenses, and a sore or dry throat. The least common symptoms relate to the chest, where some people get true asthma while working in individual buildings. Very occasionally, there is a recurrent flu-like illness that lasts for about 24 hours. The illness is most likely to begin on the first day of exposure to the building. As a lot of the symptoms resemble those of the common cold, many people feel that sick building syndrome is due to infection introduced from outside and spread via the building's air conditioning system. It is unlikely that infections cause the syndrome. However, because the symptoms usually occur on a daily or at least weekly basis, more often than new infections can be acquired. Almost every item of office equipment has been blamed for the syndrome at one time or another. Very old photocopying machines produced a substantial quantity of ozone, but this is not a problem with the new machines. And it is highly unlikely that photocopies produce any generalized problem in the office environment. Similarly, visual display units, VDUs, are frequently blamed, but the symptoms of sickness within an office building are as common in those not working with the VDUs as they are the VDU operators. Working with VDUs can cause problems with posture and glare, however, and there is a very rare skin rash associated with VDU work. Thus, while working for more than 6 hours a day on a VDU may increase the symptoms of sick building syndrome by increasing stress, the units themselves are not responsible. Again, a study in Copenhagen has found that symptoms are increased by working with carbonless paper. But as VDUs are replacing this product, it is unlikely that changing office technology is going to make much difference. Formaldehyde released from particle boards and furnishings has also been blamed, but there is little evidence that there is a relevant problem. Those blaming a lack of ions in the air have installed ionizers, but experiments with genuine ionizers have shown no benefit over dummy machines, although some ionizers are good at cleaning the air if the air is dirty. By far and away, the major source of air pollution in offices is cigarette smoke, and it seems that only low concentrations are required to produce symptoms, as active smokers have similar problems to passive smokers, those exposed to other people's smoke at work. On the other hand, those workers who do not smoke themselves and do not work in the vicinity of a smoker are much less prone to suffer from symptoms of building sickness. Passive smoking is more likely to occur in large open plan areas than in individual rooms, and it is true that the symptoms of sick building syndrome generally increase in these areas. Other factors that may contribute are the lack of privacy and lack of control of the environment that characterize working life in open plan offices. Lack of control of both job and environment is a repeating theme in the analysis of sick building syndrome, and workers under stress have more problems than less stressed workers. Interestingly, stress is more common in men than in women, even doing the same job, and is more common in managers than clerical workers. But apart from stress, women have more problems than men, and it is not yet known why. Secretarial and clerical workers generally have more problems than managers, but this may be because senior staff are more able to change their working environment and they benefit from having the pick of the accommodation. While sick building syndrome is not caused by air conditioning spreading infections among the workforce, the worst cases are still found in sealed, air-conditioned buildings rather than naturally ventilated buildings with opening windows and radiator heating. Why this is so is not completely clear, but it may again relate to the fact that workers have no control over their heating and air supply. Another cause may be contaminants from the coolers and humidifiers that are present in some ventilation systems. Symptoms are also worse in government buildings than those run by private employers. This is because the government buildings tend to be poorly maintained and of poorer quality. Building maintenance is a recurring problem. Many of the air conditioning systems are inadequately set up, and even major faults like ducting not being connected and fans being put in the wrong way round are found with surprising regularity. What can be done? The building services manager should understand the building's ventilation system and be able to act as communicator between the office workers and the ventilation engineers. Moving a desk away from drafts or glare may be all that is required. Some workers, for example, have fewer headaches near windows where there is more natural light. Different people within the same office will want different temperatures. If the system is unable to cope, wearing more or less clothing may be all that is required. If many people are complaining, the ventilation system should be investigated by a competent heating engineer. Thorough office cleaning may help. A no-smoking policy in the office will produce substantial benefits. Pollution from cigarette smoke far exceeds that from anything else. Blinds and ventilation controls should be used to maximum advantage to avoid heat gain in the building when the sun is low.
Here's a letter from Andrew Priest in Inverness, Scotland. He writes with the answer to my competition, so I'll be in touch with you, Andrew, about that and let you know on the air in a couple of weeks. I listen to your broadcasts on 6205 kHz on a Philips 22RH701/65Z Hi-Fi, bought second-hand for £7 with a long wire aerial in the loft. You have a strong signal with very little interference or fading during daytime. You can also be heard on a Ferguson 3T28 radio cassette recorder with its whip antenna, but not so strong. Good to hear you back after the break, providing a very worthwhile service of information previously only available to subscribers of the various publications you use. That's right, Andrew Priest, Inverness in Scotland. Hello. Sparks from Radiofax 6205 12255. And here's a special report from Electronics Times. Shopping for secrets. In rendezvous owing more to Selfridges than to Smiley, Richard Baum investigated industrial spying. South Audley Street in the heart of London's Mayfair. Somewhere along this high-rent roads lives Communication Control Systems, CCS, the UK arm of what is claimed to be the world's largest counter-surveillance company. Having seen one James Bond film too many, I'm half expecting its entrance to be hidden behind a secret door. I am wrong, of course. With its brightly lit window, packed with night vision goggles and recording briefcases, and a sign that reads Counter Spy Shop, it could not be more visible. Inside the shop, I am met by Managing Director Conrad Sandler. It is the kind of implausible name found in spy novels. And, like the fictional heroes, he is ridiculously well-spoken. One almost suspects the name has been faked to impress customers. The glass cabinets in the shop display electronic gadgets of the type advertised in magazines sent with credit card bills, albeit on the themes of counter-surveillance and personal security. The counter-spy shop, says Sandler, is not our real business. He leads me to the back of the shop and through a door disguised as a bookcase. In 1988, three men were convicted of bugging the telephone line at the home of a director of Comet, the electrical retailer belonging to the Woolworth Group. The offence took place 2 years earlier, when Woolworths was fighting a takeover bid by Dixons. One of the accused told the court he had been hired by Dixons to investigate former staff, a charge which Dixons refused to comment on. Then, last year, when Lane Properties was resisting a takeover attempt by P&O, a bug was found in a senior executive's office at Lane's headquarters. P&O denied it was responsible, and described Lane's decision to report the discovery to the City Takeover Panel as wholly mischievous. Industrial espionage seems commonplace. You do not have to walk far down Tottenham Court Road to find a shop selling bugs for under £50. It is not illegal to buy or sell bugging equipment, although their use in this country inevitably means using an unlicensed transmitter, interfering with a telephone line, or misusing commercially confidential information, all of which are forbidden. CCS is one of the growing number of companies being called in by companies and institutions to sweep boardrooms for bugs. Its customers range from property companies, where tough competition for lucrative deals means espionage is a regular occurrence, to what Sandler refers to as the top end of the government. But this is just a small part of its business. The room behind the bookcase, where CCS brings its professional customers, is packed with hardware such as scramblers and voice stress analyzers, all manufactured by the company. One current bestseller is a digital audio tape machine modified to record all outgoing and incoming faxes. As well as providing a hard record of information sent and received, it is a strong deterrent to the staff using the fax to leak secrets to competitors. Much of the equipment is sold overseas. While we were talking, the telephone rang with an order from Abu Dhabi for a call tracer. The company also makes equipment to order. It is currently developing a very, very sophisticated transmitter for a customer afraid of being kidnapped. Curiously enough, S-Scan Electronics, a small manufacturer and hi-fi retailer on the rather less fashionable Caledonian Road near King's Cross, is developing a very similar product. The transmitter will be hidden in an inconspicuous object such as a pen. Unlike the receiver, which, covered in concentric circles of LEDs, sounds like something out of a cheap science fiction film. While CCS thinks it is irresponsible to sell bugs, S-Scan has no such qualms. Its transmitters range from simple black boxes for attaching to telephones to bugs hidden inside mains sockets, calculators and fountain pens. Components are surface-mounted using a line S-Scan bought 3 years ago. Although Shayar Ashfari, managing director, does not ask customers what they intend to do with their bugs, he said he would never knowingly sell them for use in industrial espionage. Despite that, he coyly admits that the company occasionally discovers its own bugs when sweeping buildings. The customers he describes as legitimate users include companies who want to listen in on their employees. Ashfari gave the example of a computer software company which could not understand why it was failing to win contracts worth $1 million a year that it should have had no trouble securing. Placing a tap on its switchboard, it discovered one of its own employees was channeling the business into a company he had set up and was running from his desk. S-Scan's counter-surveillance equipment includes a telephone with a light that flashes if it detects a bug on the line. bug detectors are particularly popular with companies setting up businesses and joint ventures in former communist countries. They're a bit suspicious. There's much talk about KGB bugging, says Afshari. Escan is also developing a pocket-sized device that vibrates if it detects a gun on a nearby person. But perhaps the most intriguing product is the stunning Shock Executive briefcase. If the case is snatched, pressing a remote control activates a power pack, which puts 40 kilovolts through the briefcase and the robber. Afshari swore that with a maximum current of 3 milliamps, the shock was painful rather than dangerous. He put it in the middle of the room and demonstrated the impressive blue sparks that crackle around the entire case when it's activated. "Try picking it up," he offered. I declined. After all, Q never asked such things of Bond, and I preferred to leave the shop stirred, not shaken. By Richard Bohm, a special report in Electronics Times.
Operating two transmitters from the Irish Republic has changed its format and now on Mondays has started programming science and technology news instead of music. The channel of 6205 kilohertz runs 24 hours a day with 1 kilowatt, whilst 12255 kilohertz operates round the clock with 200 watts.
16 years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios, to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalized in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie,
the station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs,
from houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town, close enough to really care as great should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station, Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
You may remember that Radio Caroline was to transmit programmes on Radio Fax. It never got much further than a rumour. However, we've been passed a letter by the station manager of Radio Caroline. The letter was written from the DTI to him, and it starts... I refer to your recent letter to Mr. Murphy about your mooted involvement with Radiofax. Your admission that you are apparently considering supplying Radiofax with taped programmes has been noted. I am not aware that any accusation has been made that you are breaking UK law in supplying material to be broadcast by Radiofax. However, this does not mean that the Radio Investigation Service should not concern itself in this matter. The radio regulatory authorities of different states frequently cooperate on matters of mutual interest. Radiofax is broadcasting in bands allocated internationally to maritime services, and its transmissions have given rise to complaints of interference. This is a matter of legitimate concern to this agency, especially in view of the possible connection with this country. The agency is therefore liaising with the authorities in the Republic of Ireland and will continue to do so. I hope you will not support Radiofax. As mentioned above, this station has caused interference in the maritime communications frequencies, which is irresponsible to say the least. If you decide nonetheless to go ahead, that fact will be communicated to the Republic's authorities. From J. L.B. Green of the Radio Communications Agency. So in a nutshell, Radiofax is legal in this country, however, it's causing interference. Trevor?
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? But let's look at this accusation seriously. All transmitters cause interference. You can say that about any service that's on the air. The point is it significant? Is it unduly harmful, and do the benefits of the new service outweigh the drawbacks? Now, if we have caused interference, this is the first we've ever heard about it. Our telephone number, our address, and our fax number are broadcast frequently. If we really were causing significant interference to any user of these frequencies, we would certainly have heard from them by now, after some 5 months. after also operating on the same frequencies back in 1988 as well. Now let's look at the frequencies we're actually on and see what's been happening on them over the past 5 or 10 years. Now 6205, first of all, in order for us to find this frequency usable at all, there were two spurious signals which had to be removed, which we're responsible for clearing the spectrum up from. First of all, a spurious output from BBC at Skelton. It was radiating approximately the same ERP from the northwest of England, and it was a mixture product arising from two transmitters operating in the 49 meter broadcast band, and they produced mixture products on 6205 and another frequency further down on 5.9 something. That mixture product has now disappeared. There was also, when this station, before this station started in this year in April, a product coming out from the USSR. It was again a mixture product from the transmitter site carrying Radio Moscow and radio station Peace and Progress. This was a product which was radiating a much higher ERP than we're operating with and was far stronger than our present signal strength in the British Isles. It would have made this frequency completely non-viable for us to operate on. Now, following faxes from us to the authorities in the USSR and to the transmission engineers in Moscow and at the transmitter sites, suddenly one Friday evening the Intermod products went down in level, and by the following Sunday evening they had disappeared altogether. There's still one spurious product on 6205 which we haven't managed to get removed. It comes out of Radio France International. They have a transmitter lower down in the 49 meter band, and it uses a switching type modulator design. And this thing has spurious products at roughly plus or minus 60 kilohertz, one of which is usually a rough, unstable, warbly signal, which is usually on the upper sideband of our 6205 transmission. It gets stronger the closer you go to France. And the other side, there's another product on the lower sideband of their signal. Now, all of these signals have been there for several years. In addition to them, there's a number station which frequency operates around this part of the band. There's RTTY and CW transmissions which are also not to the band plan. Now, what is the band plan? Well, we've got a big pile of paper here which is the marine allocation tables. So we know exactly what the frequencies here are supposed to be used for. There are 6 single sideband channels every 3 kilohertz in this part of the spectrum. Now, there's very light usage in the developed parts of the world, including Europe, and our monitoring confirms this. In fact, the only regular social net, or only regular net that goes on these frequencies, is a social chatting net between North Sea supply vessels, usually on 6221, and they're virtually the only users of these frequencies operating in English. Also in the North Sea and North Atlantic area, there's Spanish, Russian, Polish, Scandinavian and French shipping, which appear occasionally in the European waters with reasonable signal strengths. And none of this represents particularly heavy usage. We don't cause any significant interference to any of these users. Now, all of this is confirmed by letters we've had from people who really know about the use of these maritime frequencies these days, people who work for British Telecom International at coast and ship-to-shore coastal stations, people with Trinity House, people with Irish Lights, and people at the Maritime Coastal Station in the Republic of Ireland. So, what it all boils down to is that we don't think we're causing any significant interference. What we're doing is a reasonable and worthwhile of a few kilohertz of the HF spectrum, and the benefits outweigh the drawbacks, or at least that's what you write to tell us.
And we'd appreciate it very much if you could write to your MP expressing your support for independent shortwave licenses, and in particular one to cover our type of programming. Our address, if you'd like to send any reply that you get or a copy of your letter you send, is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG. And as always, if you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. We'll also give you a mention on this programme. Sparks is every Monday and Tuesday. Fresh Radio Facts programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. This week's Sparks is presented by Andy Burnham, Trevor Brook and Ruth Phillips. And I'll leave you for a moment to ponder the implications of this quote from John Redwood, the Minister for the DTI.
We want to see full use made of the radio spectrum in the United Kingdom.
McCormick and Richard Tauber are singing by the bed. There's a glass of punch below your feet and an angel at your head. There's devils on each side of you with bottles in their hand. You need one more drop of poison and you'll dream of foreign lands.
When you pissed yourself in Frankfurt and got sipped down in Cologne, and you're at the rattling stack trains as you lay there all alone, Frank Ryan bought your whiskey in a brothel in Madrid, and you text some fucking black shirt who was cursing all the yids, and a sick bit of Coop Cullen will kneel and say a prayer, but a ghost are rattling at the door and the devil's in the chair. In the Euston Tavern, you screamed it was your shell, but I wouldn't give you service, so you kicked the windows out. They took you out in Turner Street, kicked you in the brains, so you went back then through a bolted door and did it all again. And a sick bit of Coot Cullen will kneel and say a prayer, and the ghosts are rattling at the door, and the devil's in the chair. Hey! Remember that foul evening when you heard the banshees howl? There was lazy, drunken bastards singing Billy in the Bell. They took you up to midnight mass and left you in the lurch. So you dropped a button in the plate and spewed up in the church. Now you sing a song of liberty for blacks and packs of jocks, and I'll take you from this dump you're in and stick you in a box. Then I'll take you to the prior and shove you in the ground, where you stick your head back out and shout we'll have another round. At the great sword of Coot Cullen we'll kneel around and cry, and God is in his heaven and Billy's down by the fire.
Here's something from Channel 4's Checkout 91 programme about new recorded music formats. They start by talking to David, who's a keen record collector.
I love listening to music, and I don't want to feel that my records, what I've spent half my life, collecting, will just be, just the old relics, basically.
So will David have to switch to CDs, or is there another, better format just around the corner? We headed for the Cornflake Shop, which sells not cornflakes, but specialist hi-fi, to keep an appointment with home technology expert Barry Fox.
Well, I think you can say that just about if you go to bed at night, by the time you wake up in the morning, there's someone somewhere will have come up with a new format. Mm. And it's happening all the time, and we've got at the moment now promise of at least two new formats, really serious formats, and one is from Philips, a new cassette to record on, and another is from Sony, which is a new, they call it mini disc, it's a little disc.
Both are due out next year, but which, if any, do you choose? Mini disc can hold 74 minutes of music on a 2.5-inch optical disc. Unlike the CD, you can record onto it. You can also record onto its rival, the digital compact cassette, or DCC. It's the same size as ordinary cassettes, but with the clarity of digital sound. DCC has got round a problem that scuppered an earlier format, digital audio tape, or DAT, which was kept from the mass market by the music industry, who were worried we'd use it to make perfect copies. There's now a protection system that stops that. And Barry Fox thinks ultimately DCC will win because it's backward compatible.
The idea of this is that if you go out and buy one of the new DCC digital players next year, you'll be able to use it either to play new digital cassettes or your existing collection of ordinary cassettes. So, I mean, my feeling that in your case, I mean, I'll lay you money that you will sooner or later start buying CDs. You'll fall in love with the system. You may very well next year, because you like digital recording and the cleanliness of it, and the lack of hiss and the lack of pops and splatter and whatever, you may well go over, when it's on the market, to using the Philips digital cassette. And then what I'm afraid you'll have at home is an LP collection, a CD collection, and a collection of two kinds of cassettes.
Barry Fox speaking on Channel 4's Checkout 91 programme. Thompson and Grundig are set to join Matsushita, Tandy and Kenwood in supporting digital compact cassette, the recording medium developed by Philips. Thompson also revealed that it helped to develop DCC and holds several patents relating to the data compression hardware. Philips has previously acknowledged only Matsushita as a co-developer. Thompson will demonstrate a prototype product to distributors at the Consumer Electronics Show in Berlin, badged with its Normend product brand name. It will join Grundig, other manufacturers and record companies at a Philips press conference to announce plans for DCC, which is due to go on sale next spring. The overwhelming support from the electronics and recording industries is a huge boost to Philips' hopes of making DCC at least as popular as CD. Sony's potential rival to DCC, a magneto-optic medium called Minidisc, is expected to make its public debut in Berlin. Sony may also use the show to confirm its broad hints that it too will make DCC machines. Along with other Japanese companies, Sony is likely to unleash widescreen TVs and D2 Mac receivers at the show, challenging plans by European manufacturers to dominate the local HDTV market. Sanyo will demonstrate a prototype 36-inch widescreen TV that uses cathode ray tubes developed by Thompson. Thompson's UK subsidiary Ferguson has delayed the launch of its widescreen TV from autumn until early next year, when it believes a stronger economy and clearer plans for the European Commission's HDTV directive will make for better sales.
Girl, you really got me going. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing. You got me so I can't sleep at night.
You got me so I can't sleep at night. Yeah, you really got me now. You got me so I don't know.
Cleverest Carburetor from Practical Motorist by Chris Webb. Once upon a time, when Rover Group was still Morris Motors, long before the days of emission regulations, the greenhouse effect, and hot wire air mass metering sequential electronic fuel injection systems, most cars had carburetors. And the best carburetor of them all, some said, was the SU. They were standard equipment on the good cars of the time, among others the MGs, Rileys, Triumphs, Wolseys, Morrises, later Austins, Old Rovers and Jaguars. SU carburetors promised the best of both worlds, power with economy. Where most rivals used a number of easily blocked fixed jets to meter the fuel, SU used a tapered needle in just one jet, which never got blocked. The amount of fuel passing through this jet was metered by the position of the needle. The system was delightfully simple. When the needle was withdrawn, so only the narrowest section of the taper was in the jet, a lot of fuel flowed out. When it was inserted, so a thicker section obstructed the jet, the fuel flow was reduced. The cleverest bit of all was fixing the needle to the underside of a piston, which rose or fell to alter the airflow in response to the throttle angle and inlet manifold vacuum. At tickover, the piston, cut off from manifold vacuum by the almost closed throttle, rested at the bottom of its stroke, allowing only a small quantity of air and fuel into the manifold. But snap the throttle open, and manifold vacuum went to work on the upper section of the piston, causing it to rise, lifting the needle, and allowing in more fuel and air. Early SUs were tuned to an even tickover by turning an adjusting nut under the jet to raise or lower it in relation to the needle. Raising the jet weakened the mixture, lowering it richened it. Putting the adjusting nut under the jet meant the float chamber had to be moved to the side, an arrangement which sometimes leaked fuel. There was another problem. In theory, the needle was supposed to operate centrally in the jet, but wear and tear being what it is, the average needle soon began to waggle around a bit. Engineers who measure jet sizes in tenths of thousandths of an inch realized that a needle biased away from the engine let in a richer mixture than one biased towards the engine. Yet another problem was the viscosity of the fuel. Just like oil, petrol thins out as it is heated. So, more warm fuel from an SU with its float chamber heated by the exhaust manifold would get past the jet than the relatively cool fuel from an SU mounted well away from the exhaust system. In an effort to overcome all these difficulties, SU came up with the HIF, Horizontal Integral Float, carburetor. On this device, the float chamber surrounded the jet, which was linked to a bimetal spring submerged in the fuel. If the fuel warmed up, the spring bent and raised the jet to weaken the mixture. If it cooled, the spring straightened a little, lowering the jet and richening the mixture. The needle was spring-loaded, so it always rubbed against one side of the jet. This meant the crescent-shaped opening around it was always on the same side, and there was no unwanted needle waggling to alter the mixture strength. The HIF quickly became standard wear on a wide variety of vehicles, ranging from the Metro, Maestro, Montego, and Jaguar to the Sherpa van. On some, it came with an automatic choke system controlled by a small electric stepping motor, a good idea that in practice could be troublesome. Many of these were converted to manual choke using conversions sold by carburetor specialists. If you have an HIF that isn't as economical as it should be, or is leaking fuel, the good news is that they very rarely wear out. The other bit of good news is that most HIFs can be overhauled at home using a variety of repair kits and without the need for any special tools. The exceptions are versions with the stepping motor. On these, the carburetor itself is straightforward, but the motor is best left alone or swapped for a manual choke kit. So, where do you start? We started by asking Malcolm Smith of the Carburetor Centre in 426 Archway Road, North London, how he would take an HIF apart. While camera poised, we watched. This is what happened. Well, the article continues with a series of photographs showing how you take the carburetor to pieces, what the problems are, and how you put it back together again. And there's the interesting comment here. I know it sounds silly to say this, but Malcolm swears he has come across some with the needle fitted upside down. Well, there's a series of 24 photographs which end, and this is how the HIF looked when Malcolm had finished. It really is the same carburetor, a gleaming finished object there. For practical motorist readers, the article ends, the carburetor centre is currently a VAT-free zone, i.e. they are giving a discount to readers equivalent to VAT. Just mention the magazine when you're talking to them. That article by Chris Webb in the August issue of Practical Motorist.
Well, there's a collector's item for the really dedicated anorak. It's Sparks from Radiofax. Here's another letter. Whipton, Essex in Devon is where David Broom writes from, no relation to the horse rider. I have written to Radiofax before, giving a report on Chrissy's programmes and signal strengths of varying times of the day some 3 months ago. I'm writing again to congratulate on the rerun of some pirate broadcasts from Caroline, Laser 558, Geronimo, Veronica and Atlanta. I could listen to them over and over again. I like the new fax format of Sparks on Monday, Chrissy on Wednesday and Alternate Fridays, Jody's Rock Show and Solid Gold Sunday. The 6205 signal is preferable to 12255 because it's stronger here. My receiver is a Raycal RA17L and 40 feet of wire in the loft. The technical programme is very good, and I hope to hear more about the progress of Radiofax achieving its licence to broadcast in England. Will this be a licence to broadcast on the medium wave or the short wave? I hope to hear more about the progress of other pirates achieving their licences in England. Well, the answer to your question is, we'd love to know. Well, either would be fine for us, I'm sure. Thanks, David Broom.
now to about my favourite place in the world, County Cork in Ireland. A story about the chief engineer of County Sound Radio, John Cahill, by Maggie Taylor in Radio World. Hopping over mountains, linking the incompatible, inventing a mechanical man, and choosing a transmitter that does not lose power at milking time are all in a day's work for John Cahill, chief engineer with County Sound Radio in Cork. Cahill has been a radio engineer in Cork since 1980, and now that County Sound bought the Cork City-based station 96FM, he is responsible for three studios in different areas. County Sound decided that the city station should retain its name and provide a sustaining service for the group's North and West Cork studios at night, plus a network news service. This meant linking three studios over difficult mountain terrain, and the task has given Cahill some unusual problems to solve. The sustaining service and network news to North Cork comes down a three-hop UHF link over the mountains using Philips aerials and Mosley and Marty links. I never envisaged a three-hop link, and neither had 96FM, Cahill said, noting that 96FM had attempted broadcasting to North Cork. I had bought Mosley links, they had bought Marty, and they are not compatible. So I devised a scheme that takes Marty links to the highest mountain. Then I combined the Marty into a composite link, which feeds to our North Cork studio in Mallow into a decoder. There it is decoded back into stereo, fed into the mixing desk, and back up a normal link. Cahill explained that he had modified a Technics tuner internally to get the composite multiplex directly into the tuner, and use the tuner's electronics to decode the stereo that is fed into the desk. It is very unusual and saved us a lot of money, he said. I already have more link frequencies than anyone else in Ireland, and thought the radio authority would not give me another. He said he did not want to push his luck, so we are sending the sustaining service off-air to West Cork from 96FM, route it through a tuner to a channel on the desk and brought up on a fader. The programmers wanted a way that would allow West Cork to take 96FM between 6 and 7pm, and then a program from North Cork that was particularly suited to the rural area from 7 to 10pm. They also did not want to have someone going in to put the fader up. So I bought a very elaborate and accurate timer and fed two tuners into it, Cahill said. I call it the Electronic Man. It changes channel automatically at 7 o'clock, and at 10 o'clock it switches back again. Something more straightforward for Cahill was installing a new Harris 3.5 kilowatt transmitter for West Cork. North Cork already has a similar Harris transmitter. Cahill said, I used a Harris medium wave transmitter in the North Cork local radio days, that's County Sound's unlicensed predecessor, and found it so incredible. Every time there was a fault, I could fix it. It was designed for an engineer to make life easy. He said he recently found a very useful feature when there was a power failure. If the power fails for an instant, the transmitter keeps running. If the power goes off completely, the transmitter will try to fire three times. This happened for Cahill when there was a surge as the station switched back to the mains from the backup generator. The transmitter went off, then fired, but the power must still have been too high. It fired again, and then the third time it stayed on, Cahill said. There is an automatic control, so you cannot go above your limit, and if the mains are fluctuating, you will not drop out either. In rural Ireland, that used to be a major problem, Cahill said. Sure enough, in winter at milking time, when the farmers switched on, the power would go way down. The range would drop off rapidly. That does not happen with the Harris. It keeps stable. There is very good monitoring, and it uses a valve, which I prefer to transistors. The transmitter for 96FM is a Continental 2.6 kilowatt. The on-air studio has an Alice mixer. At North Cork, we use Elo mixers. In our outside broadcast unit, we have a Soundcraft 200B that I have found to be an excellent machine. In Bandon, we have a 16-track Soundtech with facilities for multi-tracking. Eventually, we are planning to have a 16-track facility at all three stations. That was by Maggie Taylor in Radio World. And a far cry from the days of ERI and WKLR. And where's that relay station down in the far west at Skibbereen, which was always off tune on its rebroadcast receiver?
Sparks on Radio Fax, 6205 and 12255. Charles Bowman writes from Poulton le Fylde, Blackpool in Lancashire. May I congratulate you on excellent programmes. I am a 14-year-old DXer and I have heard over 70 free radio stations. And he's right. There's an enormous list of shortwave stations he's logged, which I'll use in a few weeks. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Hurt me more.